This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show. It is Wednesday, April the 20th. What have we got coming up? Looking first of all at some of today's big stories. You've got the global economy, the anniversary of oil at minus $37 a barrel. Yep, it was 2 years ago today. We'll get the views of the oil expert Justin Dargan a little bit later on, and producer Isa is going to play for you the song that was number one on the Billboard Hot 100 2 years ago today. What else have we got? Serena Kelly's going to give us an update on visas. So many questions about that. Not only Serena, but also David McKenzie of the recruitment firm McKenzie Jones. He says, if you take a look at all of these new visas that we've got, it really speaks to a change in the way we're working rather than having a job, to something more akin to the gig economy and having several different jobs. So we'll hear from him. He's DMAC number one. DMAC number two is David McWilliams. He's the Irish economist. He's a comedian. He's a philosopher. He's a great guy, is DMAC, and you're going to enjoy his interview. First up, though, let's dive in to those big economic stories.
We've been reflecting on a bit of an anniversary, Dini, for all things oil. And you've been speaking to Shadi about this one.
Yeah, that's right. It's 2 years ago today. You were here, Tom, 20th of April.
Remember, yeah.
Oil hit minus $37 a barrel.
Yeah.
Were we in full lockdown 2 years ago? I think we were.
Yeah.
SK's in the studio. SK, were we in full lockdown last year? April 20th?
April 20th. No, because it kind of came into effect March, April. Yeah, I'd say people were still kind of staying at home.
But did you still need a police report to go to?
Oh, a permit. I would say you'd probably, yeah, I think that was in a while. It was round about probably close to this. It wasn't only in place for a couple of months, the permit system.
Crikey, it was, wasn't it? Minus 37 bucks a barrel. And here we are. That was US crude. Today, it's what right now $103.51 a barrel. If you had told me 2 years ago that oil in 2 years' time would have been 103 bucks a barrel, I would have honestly told you to go and seek medical attention. I just wouldn't have thought it possible. But here we are. So we've been speaking to many people about this morning, including Shadi Shah El Borno, Senior Director of Group Research at Emirates NBD, and we asked him, did you think in those dark days in April 2020 that oil could climb so high so soon?
Well, certainly the backdrop has changed significantly over the past 2 years from the opening up of the global economy as we exit COVID-19 down to the latest geopolitical tensions between Russia and Ukraine. All these factors have been supporting a market that is tight on oil supplies.
Right, that was then, this is now. Of course, the big economic story at the moment, according to the IMF and the World Bank, their spring meetings happening in Washington at the moment, is the situation in Ukraine. Overnight, the IMF cutting its forecast for global economic growth down to just over 3.5%. However, its forecasts for this part of the world, the Gulf oil-producing states, including the UAE, remain robust. 4.2% growth they're forecasting for the UAE this year. Here's Shadi's take.
Well, certainly the revised outlook comes as no surprise, given the IMF said it has revised downward its medium-term outlook for all groups, with the exception being commodity exporters, of which the UAE is a part through its oil exports, given the benefits from the surge in recent energy prices.
And his quick take on the global forecast, slashing, as the World Bank did, their global forecast by about 1% for this year.
Certainly a significant downgrade to global growth, and the second time the IMF revises its forecasts this year. They now project global growth of 3.6% in both 2022 and 2023. So that's a drop of 0.8 percentage points and 0.2 percentage points, respectively, just from its forecasts last January. And this is due to the war's impact on Russia and Ukraine and the global spillover.
Shadi El Borno of Emirates NBD.
I want to One of the other big talkers of the day has been all things visas. I've got loads of questions to put to Serena in just a few moments' time. But we spoke to Jessica Ashford about this one. Basically, there has been an overhaul, or certainly some major changes to the existing visa system announced within the last 24 hours. It seems that they're aimed at attracting and retaining global talent, which is very much in demand at the moment. Jessica Ashford is the COO of Pro Partner Group, who joined us sent us her thoughts about what the new visa overhaul means for business formation, setup, and talent acquisition. In fact, when it comes to attracting talent and skilled workers to the UAE, Jessica believes that this is going to be a major tool.
It will help increase or encourage an influx of the talented or skilled workers in the UAE. So, for example, one of the amendments has been an expansion in the categories for the Golden Visa. And of these categories, there is now an option for outstanding students or graduates, as well as for exceptional talent. So obtaining a Golden Visa is certainly an attractive option for people that would fall within these categories. Another addition is a new 5-year residency visa for skilled employees, which means that they can come over without having a sponsor or an employer. So there's certainly additional options for people of this category.
Additional options are plenty, that's for sure. Those are the thoughts of Jessica Ashford. And we also just wanted to know what the impact she thought would be on the economy.
The amendments and additions that have been made to the law are certainly positive and will be welcomed. And I believe that they will likely encourage more people not only to visit the UAE, but also to reside here. For people that previously found it maybe potentially difficult to visit the UAE for visa purposes, may find it now more accessible, and it will certainly allow people to stay for lengthier periods of time. It will definitely help encourage more skilled labour in the UAE, and ultimately this will hopefully boost the job market as well as increase the local talent pool, as well as increasing tourism. So if you take all of this into consideration, I think it can only have a positive impact on the local economy.
Loads of questions coming through on this one. We will address a few more of those with Serena now. Just before that, though, let's get a quick update on a couple of the other stories that the news team are following that you can find out more details on the ARN news site. What's this new web portal that's been mentioned?
Yeah, so it's now a lot easier to know the chances of a check bouncing. So the UAE Credit Agency, Al Ittihad Credit Bureau, they've launched a web portal. So it allows businesses and individuals to instantly know the likelihood of a check issued through a local bank getting bounced. The Check Score Initiative is what it's called. It went through months of rigorous trial testing before going live. Now, it can be accessed through the Bureau's website and the mobile app. And in just over a month, the Check Score app has scanned checks with the overall value to over 815 million dirhams. So if you want the website, it's via the AECB website, aecb.gov.ae/check-score, or just search for the Check Score on your app store as well.
Significant day for the 1 billion meals campaign?
Yeah, well, because we're also marking the Zayed Humanitarian Day today, the UAE celebrating that. So coinciding with the day, the second auction for license plates is taking place to support the 1 billion meals campaign. And that's the one that's providing food and meals for those in need in 50 countries during the holy month of Ramadan. So this specific auction is happening in Abu Dhabi today. It's going to be held at Emirates Palace, and you're going to have the opportunity to bid on 5 special vehicle plate numbers. Those are going to be up for grabs, and 10 special mobile numbers as well, because obviously over the weekend we were reporting the one that happened in Dubai as well that was supporting the 1 billion meals initiative.
Right, obviously visas and more visas. That's the big talking point of the day. Do we know when this is going to start or come into effect?
September. That's according to the Federal Authority for Identity, Citizenship, Customs and Port Security. They've only mentioned the month. They haven't given a specific date. And just off the back of, was it Jessica who you were?
Yep.
How she mentioned the outstanding students and graduates, that this is an option with regards to, because the UAE has expanded the eligibility criteria for the Golden Visa. So when it comes to outstanding students and graduates, you've got secondary, to university, but also graduates from the best 100 universities worldwide as well. So they don't necessarily have to have attended an educational institution here in the UAE. But as I was saying, the UAE visa system, all the new amendments that were announced yesterday and the day prior, they're all coming into effect in September. You've got the 60-day tourist visa. They've raised the age limit for sponsoring children from 18 to 25. And among the new visas, the five-year renewable green visas, there's three of them, you will be able to sponsor your immediate family members as well under those. And also they've extended grace periods for up to 6 months when your visa expires or has been cancelled for the residency.
Okie dokie, here comes your quickfire round.
Go for it.
It's not a Friday, but we will take any opportunity we get. I'll ask Serena quickfire. Mustafa wants to know, what about sponsoring parents?
Under the golden visa, that hasn't been specified, but obviously the standard regular sponsoring of parents, that you can still go through those protocols as usual.
Somebody else wants to know, on a normal work visa, how long can someone be out of the country before having to return the visa being auto-cancelled? Used to be 6 months, I think. Still the case? Or is it going to be longer?
No, it's still 6 months. They haven't specified anything new on that. The only reference was towards the golden residency visa holders. It doesn't matter how long they are outside of the country for, their visa will still remain valid.
Thanks for those. One more for you with regards to all things visa. This one coming through from Sharla this morning. Sharla asking, what happens to those who apply for the golden visa prior to the new reforms in case their application is rejected? Will they be given the chance to apply again for a self-employment five-year green visa instead, for examples? That's from Sharla.
I think you should still be able to go through the processes, but remember, it's only coming into effect in September.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Do you know what game we got to play, Tom? The pop culture game. What was number one on April the 20th, 2020? Producer Isa knows.
Oh, really?
And she's getting the song for us, which we'll play. Should we have it now?
If you want it, yeah.
Okay, let's go for it.
What days were this?
This was April the 20th, 2020.
Wow. Difficult one, isn't it?
Blinding Lights by The Weeknd.
I know, but it's the pronunciation of Weeknd that makes it difficult, isn't it?
Weeknd,
isn't it?
By some measures, that is the most successful song in history.
Really?
Yeah, it is, in terms of revenue or number of plays ever. Yeah, and it's only 2 years old. Anyway, let's talk about oil, because 2 years ago today, the price of crude, US crude, fell to minus $37 a barrel. Today, we are above 100. Who could have predicted it? Joining us on the line with some perspective is the senior energy and geopolitical expert at the University of Oxford, Justin Dargin. Justin, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's just rewind a couple of years ago. Where were you? It's one of those moments. Where were you when oil hit minus 37 bucks?
Well, actually, I was trying to get on the last plane out of the UK to get back to the US. Wasn't certain if I was going to make it. But it's just been a wild, wild ride. I mean, initially, what we can say is that this started by the fact that Russia did not agree with Saudi Arabia and also OPEC's decision to try to implement further oil production cuts. And as a result, Russia walked away from the table. Then that's how you actually had the start of this price war at the very start of the pandemic. And then so these two events obviously pushed the oil price down to a very low level. However, one thing that we did see is that throughout this market share competition between Saudi Arabia and Russia, it was mostly Russia that was focused on the US market, because Russia still was, we could say, hurting or smarting from the fact that the Trump administration had placed sanctions on Rosneft in February of 2020. So to a certain degree, Russia want to avenge that and want to reduce the ability of the United States to wield its favorite weapon, which is sanctions. So what Russia was attempting to do was to more or less diminish the power of the US economy through targeting the shale oil sector. I mean, so that's how really we got in this type of position. But then what we saw is that as Russia and Saudi Arabia started to recognize that neither of them would be able to benefit from a continuation of extremely low oil prices, then that's where we saw OPEC Plus come together and form a type of accommodation.
Yeah, so it's hard to believe, isn't it, that 2 years ago, Saudi Arabia and Russia did have a bit of a falling out, it's probably too strong, but a very strong difference of opinion. And yet this weekend, maybe it's no coincidence, we've had Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia, and Vladimir Putin on the phone having a call about OPEC Plus and about oil production. Clearly, lessons have been learned from these major producers, it would seem, Justin.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we could say that OPEC and Russia have had a symbiotic relationship for decades. And so even if we go back to 1973, which was the oil embargo, Russia actually was able to catapult to one of the world's leading oil and gas producing countries because of that, and because of the price of a barrel of oil increased from about $3 to $12 per barrel. So you saw an influx of just a massive foreign revenue influx into the Soviet Union's coffers. And then, however, there was also a falling out, we could say, between the Soviet Union and Saudi Arabia when Saudi Arabia increased its production substantially from about 2 million barrels per day to about 10 million barrels per day within a four-month period in 1986. And many people believe that that was actually one of the main points of where the Soviet Union began its slow descent into its final collapse. I mean, so we could see that there has always been a type of love-hate relationship, we could say, between the two countries, just as it relates to oil production, due to the fact that sometimes they have divergent interests in the way that they want to pursue their export policies.
So, minus 37 bucks a barrel couple of years ago, over $100 a barrel now. Where do you think the sweet spot, the natural equilibrium for oil is? For me, it's about $70 a barrel. And people like my co-host Tom and Brandy tease me because I always say, we're going to be $70 by Christmas, because I believe that's the natural equilibrium that keeps producers happy and they'll invest enough to invest in new infrastructure, but it's not too high for consumers. But that's just I plucked that number out of the air. For you, where's the natural equilibrium price for oil?
Actually, that's quite a fair point. I would say that one thing we do have to consider is the break-even oil prices that many of the OPEC countries have to acquire in order to keep their budgets solvent. I mean, so for instance, if you look at Saudi Arabia, it's over $80 per barrel that it must receive in order for it to continue its budgetary outlays and to remain solvent. And in particular, we have to look at the fact that Saudi Arabia, for instance, and also Russia, they have a lot of massive infrastructure projects that they're attempting to engage in. So if you look at, for instance, Saudi Arabia's Vision 2030. So I would say that in order for many of the oil producing countries to be happy, I would say that the price would actually have to be around $90 per barrel. And of course, in terms of the U.S. shale industry, we're looking at about $40 to $50 as the break-even price for them to be able to recoup their operating costs at the same time. So I would say anywhere above $90. And I think we've entered into a new reality now, considering the fact that the world is attempting to decarbonize at the same time. So I think that the era of extremely low oil prices for the foreseeable future is in the past.
Justin, great talking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much for being with us. Justin Dargin, Senior Energy and Geopolitical Expert at the University of Oxford.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a roller coaster, hasn't it? That's for sure in terms of the price of oil. What's the high of oil? What did we get up to? We got up to...
Well, I remember...
137, didn't we?
We did. We got into the high 130s about 6 weeks ago. I remember the day I moved back from London to Dubai in 2008, just as the financial crisis was unfolding, we were 147 bucks a barrel. I think it was Bastille Day, 14th of July.
Wow.
And then within 6 months, we were down at 38 bucks a barrel. So I was like, I'm going back to the oil-rich Middle East. Aren't I smart? That didn't work out very well.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
No denying that one of the big talkers at the moment is, of course, one of the big stories of the day, but also of yesterday. It got talked about around dinner tables last night. It's been talked about again today as people try and get more details on the UAE's confirmation that major changes will take place to the visa system aimed at attracting and retaining global talents and skilled workers from all over the world. How's it going to impact your life here? Is it going to attract more people here? Is it good for business? Let's find out from a man in the know, the managing director of Mackenzie Jones, friend of the show. David Mackenzie joins us live in studio. David, always good to see you. All well?
I'm really good, actually. Very good. Thank you.
How was the water this morning?
It was lovely. It's beautiful. No jellyfish either. So for me, that's always a result. No stings.
That's just to clarify on this one. David's been swimming, all right?
Yes,
nothing
I have
to do with a refreshment in the green room or anything like that, okay? Let's also turn our attention now to what this... I mean, let's get your reaction first and foremost to these changes. What do you make of them?
I think they're great. I mean, I think what the UAE is moving towards is the gig economy is coming. And the UAE is gearing itself up to do that. So I'm more interested in things like the business visas and the temporary work mission visa, because I think also it's starting to get rid of the sponsorship scheme that we have here. And I think that can be quite draconian in growth. So I think it's good. It's all good for me. Certainly from a recruitment perspective, I'm very pleased.
How is it going to bolster the economy? Is it in terms of people looking for options already here, or again, will this attract talent from outside?
I think it's more about attracting talent inwardly. I think people who are here are sorted, they've got jobs and they can move jobs with their current visas from free zone to free zone. I think what it does, if you think about companies now, they have to put people on their visas. It costs a lot of money. They have to healthcare, etc. If you're launching a new product, a new brand, a new service, and you want to hire in, say, a front-end developer or a marketing manager for 6 months to launch this product, and then they go, your costs are reduced massively. And it's very effective. So I think what we'll see is companies becoming a lot leaner and only hiring in staff when they need to for specific products.
So I'd not thought of it that, and I'd looked at it from the sort of individual point of view and forwarding one sort of individual career and go, oh, I'll choose this one or I'll choose that one. But again, from a company point of view, you can now pick and choose what kind of visa you put employees on.
In theory, yes. The mission visa, you could hire somebody for a six-month project. You could bring them in, they do the work, and then they leave. So your medical, your visas, everything will be reduced. Now, from a people perspective, this is great, because if you look at, we were talking about my kids earlier on, kids these days don't do jobs for life. Mm. You know, they want to do 3 months here, do a new website or launch a new brand, go off skiing for 3 months, come back again, do something else. They have a very different perspective on careers. And I think what the UAE is gearing itself up for is what's the future of work going to look like? And it's going to be a gig economy. It won't be jobs for life anymore.
So from a recruitment point of view, and for, given your expertise in that field, why now? Why are the UAE doing this now?
I think we're seeing the whole global economy shifting. Mm. So during COVID, everyone wanted to go back home to be near their loved ones, their parents, etc. And what we saw is a drain of talent from the UAE.
Okay.
And actually, if you look at what we call the PIF effect, Saudi is sucking talent out of this region.
Yeah.
In fact, Riyadh's sucking talent out of Saudi. So we're trying to attract people that would not normally think of the UAE as a work option. And it could be those people that just want to work for 6 months and then leave. Or it could be our demographics change massively. It's no longer, you know, people with 12, 13-year-old kids. It's younger people. It's first married and it's young kids. Because, schooling and things are very expensive and companies are not paying schooling anymore.
Let's talk cash,
cash.
We can, Dave, because again, we're waiting for details on how much these are going to cost as well. But in terms of just sort of moving forward, I mean, we live in a tax-free environment, but could this be a potential revenue stream for the UAE in terms of taxing of...
Yes. Now, let me put a controversial point. Is this our next step towards income tax? Because if you've got a young gig economy person coming here earning good money and then leaving after 3 months, how's the UAE going to capture that revenue? Mm. So they'll spend it here, but they may not do. So is this the prelude to us becoming more of a taxed regime? Who knows?
David's just used the T word.
I know, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use that on this programme.
Taxi for DMACC.
My golden visa is now gone.
It will be interesting, though, because it's not going to come for free, is it?
No, and I think...
Nothing comes for free. And a lot of people have talked about the golden visa, which we all think is an amazing initiative here. But it doesn't come for free.
No, and also the green visa. You know, they're talking about you've got to earn a minimum salary of 15,000 dirhams. So they're aiming at a certain market. So as a company, will the mission visa be prohibitively expensive for you to take? It could be. I mean, if they start making it so expensive that actually there's no point in doing it, it doesn't alleviate the costs, then we have to relook at it. I hope it'll be very cost effective for companies and businesses.
So, David, let me ask you from a different perspective. You're a business owner. Mm. How many staff do you have at the moment?
22.
22. And I guess they are full-time staff on your work visas.
Yes.
So in 2 or 3 years' time, do you think that your workforce will look different, that you'll have maybe, you know, a core of full-time staff, but maybe a few, call them freelancers, call them what you will, contractors on these kind of visas working for you, doing work, hiring people, putting people in positions, but not that traditional employment contract?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the vision of where business is going. If you look at some of the big multinationals here during COVID, they stripped out lots of cost. And what they've become is very flat businesses. And they've learned to operate as a flat business. And their shared service could be in Singapore, China, India, wherever. I think what will happen is companies will become smaller here, a lot leaner, but a lot more effective.
Dini made a really good point a little earlier on as well, and it needs addressing because it is a sort of fundamental change to the infrastructure of work here, not just from an expat point of view, but for a local, an Emirati point of view as well. Have you got any sort of take on to what the reaction will be across the wider local workforce?
Not so much. I mean, we place Emiratis into roles. We place a lot of Saudis into roles as well. And I think what you're finding, the younger generation of Emiratis are very different to my age profile. They're not used to the sponsorship system. They're used to working and being promoted. And I think there's a very different culture creeping in now. So I think the UAE is becoming a very normalized work environment now. And I think actually this sort of visa scheme is cutting edge. Nobody else in the GCC is doing it. Now, Saudi will do it, without a doubt, because they are moving at a massive pace.
And is that a challenge? That's basically a challenge at the moment,
isn't it? There is, yeah.
Yeah, there's, I mean, a bit there's of no getting away ship. From it. That's what
the Saudi economy is hyperinflating at the moment. We cannot find staff there. Trying to find Saudi nationals to do national jobs, they're just getting 30 to 40% increases in salaries, and that's not sustainable. So at some point, they have to relook at their expat workforce. And the salaries for certain of the PIF companies have been capped now. So the days of you going in there and 60 or 70% more than you weren't here are over. Mm. You're getting 30% max.
Yeah. Fascinating times to be in recruitment. Fascinating times to be here in the UAE and across the region. David, really appreciate your time this morning. Thanks so much indeed for coming in.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. David McKenzie, joining us live here in studio.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Talking economics now with the Irish economist David McWilliams. He's a bit of a celebrity economist. He started his career at the Central Bank of Ireland. Fine, standard stuff. Then went to work in London for banks like UBS and others and worked around the world. But for the last 20 years or so, he's been an independent economist and author. He's a podcaster and he's known as a bit of a maverick economist within these circles. I had an extended conversation with him yesterday about a bunch of stuff, but we started with the here and now. The big economic story of the day is the situation in Russia and Ukraine and the economic fallout. It's what everyone's talking about at the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank in Washington at the moment. And in particular, we started talking about the relationship between Russia and Germany when it comes to energy, Germany's reliance on Russian energy, and David, who's a big fan of Germany and spent a lot of time there and has worked in Germany, says he thinks Germany has got it wrong.
So my own sense is that I find very disappointing, particularly as a member of the European Monetary Union, where Germany was only too willing to impose and agitate for austerity against Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland about 10 or 15 years ago. And now when a small bit of austerity is required, they won't accept it. And what is interesting is if you look at all the great German economic institutions, and there are many, almost to an institute. They've said that cutting gas supplies now would have a sudden stop in Germany, but it would be worth about 2 percentage points of GDP, maybe 3. I mean, that's nothing. So I think in the overall sense that countries need to have moral compasses as well as economic strategies. And I think Germany's moral compass is wrong at this one.
For whatever reasons, inflation is certainly an issue at the moment. The spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank going on at the moment in Washington, I'm sure you're following them closely. I mean, it's well documented that inflation is soaring and the Ukraine war is part of it, whether it's the cost of cooking oil or wheat or energy, as you alluded to earlier on.
The inflation we have now is a consequence of many things, but I'm actually of the view that the inflation we have now is not that it's temporary, it's not temporary. We are in a different real world, okay? And when I say that, I think that I like to look at economics in large, and policy, and politics in large, maybe multi-annual, multi-decade cycles. And I think that where we are now is we are coming to the end of a cycle which probably started around the mid-80s, the early 90s. Let's say, let's just for argument's sake, let's say that cycle began with Paul Volcker in the early 1980s in the United States, trying to crush the inflation of the 1970s. And he did this with, it's a bizarre to imagine, with a Fed funds rate above 20%. Okay, it's very, very difficult for, you know, modern listeners to get their heads around that type of real interest rate. Okay, and then we go into a period of very low inflation, of low biases towards low levels of government spending, a obsession with government surpluses, if we can, an obsession with independent central banks, an obsession with, on the micro level, shareholder value, an extraordinary return to capital all over the Western world, at the expense of the return to labor, so real wages falling, but dividends and rents rising dramatically. And this has been an ideology, a bias, all of my economic life, okay? I joined central banking in the early 1990s when this ideology was at its most dramatic, I would say, and had its most zealots and converts, okay? And that goes on for a long time, and it produces very, very strong rates of growth, and it produces some elements of economic, a fantastic growth rates in certain areas. The wall comes down, China comes into the real world, India comes into the real world, Soviet Union breaks apart, it comes into the Western world to a degree. We have globalization, we have the free movement of capital, all those good things, Richard. But within every ideology and with every policy, within them is the seeds of its own destruction. And within this particular policy, which probably culminated with QE after the 2008 crisis, the major problem is it spawns inequality. And inequality in democracies, Louis Brandeis, who was a very brilliant American lawyer in the 1940s, said about equality, inequality, he says, you can have democracy or you can have inequality, but you can't have both. So inequality is inimical with democratic politics.
Why?
Okay, that's because the poor will vote you out. Okay? So if you have a democracy, so capitalism is based, like I say, democracy is based on one man, one vote. Okay? Inequality is based on one man, a million votes. Rich man, a million votes. Poor man, no votes. So at a certain stage, those two ideologies clash together, okay? And they reach tipping points. And I think that tipping point was reached in Britain with Brexit, in America with Trump, in Western Europe with a variety of different populist leaders over the last 4 or 5 years, okay? And then it just becomes part of, oh, okay, so we're at this stage. And of course, what did the populist leaders do? They took the people who were locked out or those who were left behind, the victims of inequality, and they said, I'm going to be your savior. And how are we going to do this? Well, we're going to be anti-globalization. You see this with Le Pen this week in France, right? The French discussion is between patriots and globalists. And if you're a globalist, you're not a patriot, and therefore you're not actually really French. That's the message. So within this 40-year cycle, lots of good things have happened, but equally inequality has become the dominant political internal dynamic in Western democracies. So what you're going to see is the pendulum swinging back. Inflation is only the reflection of pricing power. So who has the power? So for 40 years, owners of capital had the power, and now workers have the power. This is what we're seeing, the great resignation. People are actually not accepting that they want higher wages. Then, of course, we have the shock of Ukraine and the shock of Russia. And, of course, the power is now on commodity suppliers, not commodity buyers. So the prices of commodities have gone up. So that's, again, is a pricing power issue. And what I think we're seeing is that the pendulum is swinging towards bigger government, social protection. And this obviously means that the rate of inflation for the next decade will be higher. So if you're looking for assets, please don't buy any assets that will actually move the opposite way to the rate of inflation, like the bond market, for example. And I just think that's where we're going. We're just going through a phase. I don't think it's a huge deal, the rate of inflation at the moment. I think that what we're seeing is a step jump upwards with higher inflation for the next 10 or 15 years, because the pricing power dynamics within societies has changed, and because in the West, we're going into a period of bigger government, not smaller government, higher taxes, not lower taxes, less profits, more wages. That's where we're going.
That's the Irish economist David McWilliam. Second part of that interview coming up, and it's interesting, it ties in with the visa conversation you were having with the other DMACC this morning, David McKenzie. He says we're moving away from a world where experts like him, he's an economist, work for the government, the central bank, or UBS, a Swiss bank. But he's just an independent guy, and he's going to talk about the economics of that coming up.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
From one of the listeners, guys, the Irish guy is fascinating. Makes so much sense. Where can we find the full interview to listen again and share with the husband?
Well, you know what? Thank you, Sharon. I spoke with David McWilliams yesterday for about half an hour. He is verbose, is David. And once he gets going, he's on a roll. But yeah, the fascinating insights. I think he's a brilliant guy. I listen to his podcast on a twice weekly basis. David McWilliam, wherever you find your podcast, the guy's brilliant. So we're going to hear the second part of that interview now. And the bit I've picked out is actually the bit about careers. And it does, as I mentioned earlier, tie in with the conversation we were having earlier on about the new visas in Dubai and how they kind of reflect the changing way of work. Because when you and I were growing up, I'm 50, you're in your 40s, it was you get a job and you go and work for X company, you go and work for a bank, you go and work for a media company, you go and work for the government, whoever it is, but you get a job. But these new visas that we have in the UAE reflect the fact that some people will do that and that's fine, and that's my job at the moment, but others will have a different path to working at the moment. So this is David McWilliams, the Irish economist, who is in his late 50s, and in his early career, his very conventional career did a degree in economics, went to work for the Central Bank of Ireland, then moved to London and worked for various international banks like UBS and many, many others. But for the past 20 years or so, he's kind of been an independent economist, doing a bit of writing, a bit of public speaking, doing a bit of consultancy. Now he's got a podcast, which he charges for through a vehicle called Patreon, and so on. And he says that speaks to the changing model for an experienced professional services person, and there are many of those in Dubai. And so, this is my conversation with David McWilliams, the Irish economist, about how the business model or the career model for a profession like an economist has changed.
I think, Richard, I just had a pathological fear of a boss for many years. It's deep within me. And my father said to me many years ago, he said, the truly free man is the man who has five bosses. So you've five different paychecks coming in, right? Little sources of income. They don't have to be huge. Some of them have to be material. And I remember he said that to me, and I was like, that's quite an interesting piece of advice. I think right now and in the future, there all of us really become our own little cottage industry, okay? Whether you're an economist, whether you're an architect, whether you're a designer, whether you're a PR person, whether you're marketing, if we're in the general area of services, we are our own cottage industries. We are our own brands, if you want to use that expression. And I really believe that one of the deepest dilemmas for economists is a fear of the real world. So despite suggesting that we can add some value talking about the real world, the vast majority of economists live in sort of a penal colony of their own mind. So they go into work, you say, like, you said JP Morgan, it could be UBS, it could be Goldman Sachs, it could be any of the big ones, right? And rather than going broad, they go very, very narrow. And then I think what happens, like it happens to lots of people, loads of friends of mine, great people, really fantastic individuals, is they become scared of the outside world. And if you look at the things that have happened in the last 10 years, right, so democratization of media, huge, huge change. You mentioned podcasting. The ability, I was a radio presenter years ago in Ireland. I know it's bizarre to go from working for UBS or BNP Paribas to being a breakfast morning host on radio, but I kind of did that. But then you had to get a job at a radio to be able to create your own audience, right? Now you can create your own audience on podcasts. You don't have to go near radio. So the gatekeeper, the guardian of information is gone. And therefore, all you need to be is a place that people trust to come. Writing columns for the newspapers, again, that's a weekly thought experiment. I've always thought the columns are always conversation starters. I don't have a monopoly of the truth, but I can ask the questions and I can push certain ideas. Kilkenomics is an economics and stand-up comedy festival that I do in a place called Kilkenny in Ireland. And I've always thought that, you know, one of my oldest friends from school, not just was Sean, but was a guy called Ard O'Hanlon, who was Father Dougal and Father Ted, you might remember that. And we spoke, I did a one-man show in the Abbey Theatre many years ago in Ireland, bringing economics to the theatre, which I actually did last week. We did a podcast show, and Ardle and I and another guy called Richard Cook, who's Ardle's manager at the time, we were chatting, and they were kind of saying, well, maybe if we put stand-up comedians on stage with economists, we can get some light as well as heat. And that has taken off. That's a great little festival. In fact, if maybe we should take it to Dubai. I think it would be a really great idea. We could do that at some stage. But my point is, and I've written books, and I'm writing a new book at the moment. I think that my only advice to people in careers, just remain relentlessly curious and open to suggestions. You know, the way the very end of Ulysses, okay? Very, very end of Ulysses. Ulysses by James Joyce is 100 years old this year. It was published on the second day of the second month of the second year of the second decade of the 20th century, right? So 2nd of February, 1922, 100 years ago this year. And the very, very last part of Ulysses is a soliloquy by Molly Bloom, which is an extraordinary soliloquy. It's a brilliant piece of work. It ends with the word yes, the most powerful word in the human language, in the English language, sorry, is to say yes, to be open to the world, to be open to adventure, to open yourself to the possibilities that are out there. And when I say to my kids, I say, just be open. And good things will happen to you. So it's been a strange career. It's been a strange journey, but it's gone, as you say, from the most conservative mainstream to maybe the most radical non-mainstream. But the idea is, go back to Molly Bloom, always say yes. And usually that opens the world. The minute you say no, you shut down the world. So always say yes, professionally, intellectually, emotionally. And I think that's the road to having a varied career.
That's the voice of David McWilliams, the Irish economist. He's not your conventional economist. He's not GDP up 2 points or down 2 points. Philosopher, comedian, conference organiser. I think he's a great bloke.
Gets my vote.
What?
Gets my vote.
Definitely.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.